The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. As Scotland prepares to go to the polls, we ask, can Alex Salmond, Scottish Nationalist, keep hold of power in Holyrood? Or can Labour snatch it back? Possibly, though whisper it, in coalition with the Liberal Democrats. And what does the election mean for relations down in Westminster? Also this week, my enemy's enemy is my friend, Vince Cable, teams up with Ed Miliband while David Cameron partners Labour's John Reid. We'll ask how the AV referendum campaign is forging some unlikely alliances. And if you think the alternative vote system is tricky, just wait till you hear what's been proposed by the Hungarian government. All that to come, and joining me to discuss it, we have in the studio The Guardian's columnist Martin Kettle, on the line from Edinburgh, our Scotland correspondent Severin Carroll, and also in the Scottish capital, Ian McWhirter, political columnist for the Sunday Herald and rector of Edinburgh University. A very warm welcome to all of you. Now, while most of the kingdom is electing councillors on the 5th of May, it falls to the Scots to choose a new government. Alex Salmond's minority SNP administration is pitching for a second four-year term, but the Labour Party has been, or had been, pushing them hard in what should have been a good year for the Reds. But Severin Carroll, we've had a very interesting overnight poll from News International. What does it show?
That's correct. News International, you may be aware of this already, that The Sun, actually a couple of days ago, declared itself quite early on for the Scottish National Party. And this morning in Edinburgh, News International actually organised a exclusive business breakfast for opinion formers with Alex Salmond, and only Alex Salmond, of the party leaders. And as a little breakfast present for him, they've delivered this, what The Times is now splashing as a poll shock, talking about the Nationalists having an unassailable 10-point lead. There's an Ipsos Mori poll out this morning which is showing that, broadly speaking, the SNP are around 10% ahead on the constituency vote and about 9.5-10% ahead on the list vote, which is quite considerable if, of course, that becomes what happens on polling day. Now, according to a seat projection by Professor John Curtis from Strathclyde, that would give the SNP a quite extraordinary 61 MSPs, the biggest party ever in the history of the Scottish Parliament, which would be just only a few short of an overall majority.
Well, I mean, whether it was renounced at a secret breakfast or not, it's quite a turnaround, isn't it? I mean, Ian McWhirter, could you fill in uninitiated Sassenachs on how the campaign's panned out? I think you've called it a Me Too election.
Well, it has been. It's been a very dramatic turnaround in the past week. It's not just this Ipsos Mori poll, but a YouGov poll the weekend indicated that the SNP were pulling ahead, particularly, intriguingly, on the list vote, on the top-up vote under the Scottish additional member system of proportional representation. And that was a very significant development because they had been trailing there. In fact, overall, the SNP had been trailing Labour by between 5 and 10 points for most of the last year, and many commentators assumed that all Labour had to do was keep their head down, not make any obvious mistakes, not allow any hostages to fortune, and they would drift naturally to power, and that Ian Gray would emerge as the next First Minister of Scotland. That hasn't happened, and I think it's partly because of this Me Too element. Rather cynically, Labour, at the last minute, on the very eve of the campaign, ditched a number of its policies and borrowed or stole from the SNP, particularly its policy on free higher education in opposition to tuition fees. Now, Ian Gray had always said that a graduate contribution was inevitable, that the present system was unsustainable, but for purely electoral reasons he abandoned that. They also adopted the policy of a council tax freeze, having opposed it for most of the last year. And I think that has been the real problem for them. They don't have a very confident or charismatic leader. That's clearly the case in Ian Gray, but I think that their cynicism and the fluidity of their policies has seriously undermined the Labour campaign. And I think now we are looking at another SNP victory, which means, and let's say they heard it here first, there will now be a referendum on independence in Scotland. Yet another referendum.
Martin, you've been up there, Ian talking there about the lack of strategy on Labour's part, the lack of solid policies. But is this more a referendum now on Alex Salmond, do you think?
Well, I think that's a good question, Tom, because I think probably a few months ago, when Labour was doing very well in the polls in comparison with the SNP, it was probably because people's thoughts were focused more on the London situation, the UK coalition, and it suited Labour to have this election in Scotland as, in a sense, a referendum on the government in London. But in fact, devolved elections are almost always about the devolved areas, as they should be. So this is a Scottish election about Scotland and who stands best, stands up best for Scotland. And as that process has developed, I think the SNP has come really back into the game. I don't think we should underestimate, though, the fact that the SNP seems to me to be cleaning up very, very well on the anti-Labour vote in Scotland. If you look at the election results in 2007, which was the last time there was an election for this Scottish Parliament, one in three voters voted for either the Liberal Democrats or the Tories. Well, today, in this latest poll, it's down to 19%. In other words, one in five, more or less. Those voters, by and large, seem to be drifting to the SNP rather than to Labour. Labour's support seems to have maxed out somewhere in the mid-30s. And they can't get above that. And that's the real message. I think that Salmond is really, through his personality and the fact he's very well regarded, he has a much, much better ratings than any of the other Scottish party leaders. You know, he's really been able to capitalise. So obviously going incredibly well.
Can I interject on this point? I mean, I have to say, Martin, the problem with that analysis is that you're comparing apples and pears, comparing the behaviour of voters in the polling booth and on polling day, the people that actually go to vote, with an opinion poll which is derived from phone conversations with people. And let's bear in mind, this poll has only actually had results from, in terms of people absolutely saying they're certain to vote, from 670 people. Now, the polls before the 2007 election had the SNP, in some cases, 10 points ahead. And what actually happened was that the margin between Labour and the SNP was far, far tighter than that. And we've got to be clear that there is a difference between what polling companies find and what actually happens on the day. Martin's there are other journalists who are involved in covering this. For instance, the Scotland on Sunday poll at the weekend, they're doing another one this Sunday. They use YouGov, a different polling company. There's muttering in the margins about whether Ipsos Mori's methodology is actually particularly effective. The Greens are certainly very annoyed because they say that when voters are prompted to respond to the question about who they would vote for on the list, Ipsos Mori apparently, now I haven't checked this, only offer four choices. And when the Greens are very much in play in some parts of the country on the list vote, they feel quite aggrieved that actually this is just skewing the result. So we have to be careful about all of this, don't we?
Of course. But most of our listeners will, our English listeners or Welsh listeners, will know who Alex Salmond is, what he sounds like, what he looks like. But fewer will know who Ian Gray is. Sev's been talking to him earlier on.
This is not a presidential election. And I do believe that the voters don't see it as a presidential election. They do see it as a choice of government. And so I think there is a contrast there. We would be focused on the things that really matter. And above all, jobs. We've illustrated that with a pretty ambitious jobs plan, eradicate youth unemployment, first term. And the contrast to that is an SNP which will always be distracted by their core purpose, which is independence.
Ian McWhirter, he says it's not a presidential election, but if it is slipping away from him, is it a case of grey by name, grey by nature?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think not even his best friends would say that Ian Gray is a charismatic politician or a charismatic leader. He was formerly the effectively the bag carrier for the former Scottish secretaries, Labour secretaries in the previous government. He's not distinguished himself, and he's never really had a very clear political persona or any clear ideology. I mean, it's very difficult to actually locate Ian Gray. Their Labour's manifesto is extremely left-wing. I mean, they have promised to abolish youth unemployment within 5 years. They are pledged to creating 250,000 new jobs in Scotland, as well as keeping free higher education, as well as maintaining the funding of the health service, as well as increasing police and teacher numbers and all sorts of other things. So it's an extremely left-wing agenda. However, he certainly comes from a much more middle-of-the-road background. And really, his inability, I think, it's Labour's strategy did make a great deal of sense. I mean, they do. Scotland is predominantly a Labour voting country. There's no doubt about that. And with the Conservatives in power in Westminster, it was a credible strategy for them to say, well, look, the Tories are back. At this time, you can't afford to flirt with independents and with nationalist parties. Now is the time to send a message to the Tories in Westminster. Scotland will not accept the deficit reduction programme, will not accept massive cuts in spending and in public sector jobs. However, I think it was a winning strategy had it not been for two factors. One is a clear effectiveness of Alex Salmond, and he is a very gifted political communicator. And I think the reason why these polls, I think, are probably accurate is because even when Labour were 10 points ahead, Alex Salmond's personal approval ratings in Scotland were stratospheric, and they have been for the last 4 years. I mean, he is more popular than all the other opposition party leaders combined. And I think probably as we get closer to the election and people are focusing more on leadership, then that is coming through now in the opinion polls. But I think, again, I just go back to this the cynicism in Labour's approach by ransacking the SNP policy agenda on things like tuition fees, by putting out this really extremely optimistic an ambitious agenda for Scotland, bearing in mind the Scottish Parliament has no real powers to deliver these kinds of jobs. And I think that taking the voters for granted, treating them with intellectual contempt, I think has rebounded in Labour very, very seriously in this election. I think it's all happened in the last 10 days.
There is a more profound problem, sorry to interrupt, but for Labour, not just about this Gray versus Salmond dynamic, but the fact that all the other front bench spokespeople for Labour are equally anonymous to most of the voters. Now, the incumbency that the SNP has had over the last 4 years running the Scottish Parliament has allowed the very, very talented people that the SNP have on its front bench to flourish in a way that Labour front benches just simply haven't been able to do. Now, Salmond rebuts Gray's claim that the SNP are just simply a one-man band by pointing out that the other members of his front bench team, that's Nicola Sturgeon, his deputy, John Swinney, Mike Russell and others, have actually got quite significant profiles, not only in their own areas, but also in the kind of specialist areas in which they work. People recognise Nicola Sturgeon on the street. They will never, ever recognise Joanne Lamont, who is the deputy leader of the Scottish Labour Party. And that is also part of the profound problem, that the SNP just have this overwhelming atmosphere of an effective and competent team. And that's what Labour really failed to address adequately.
Martin, someone who works in the beating heart of London Labour down here said to me that they'd find it very hard not to vote for the SNP in Scotland simply because what that country's going to need over the next few years is someone to bang the drum, get as much money out of the limited resources on offer as possible and not be compromised by any other considerations.
Well, I mean, you know, one hesitates to say things about Scotland when one doesn't live there, and you know, I'm sure the others will jump down my throat when I say
when I say this.
But I think it has always felt to me as though the Scottish Labour Party does have somewhere lurking within it its inner nationalist, and its inner nationalist is getting a hearing in the manifesto Ian was talking about. I mean, that makes me ask this question, which I think is really tantalising. Since the SNP and the Labour Party in Scotland ostensibly agree on so much, and since even on this poll, neither of them is likely to get an absolute majority in the seats in the Holyrood Parliament, why can they not form a coalition government?
Because
they hate each other, is the answer, isn't it?
That's tribalism.
But Martin, there's another point we ought not to forget, is that this is something that was certainly true during the last Labour governments, is that Labour sent its best talent south. Now, of course, a lot of people in England may quibble with the fact that the Scottish members of the cabinet were actually particularly great people to have around, but they were undoubtedly absolutely pivotal to the new Labour project. They were some of the best political brains in Britain. And that is one of Labour's greatest problems in Holyrood, is that the people that are there, whilst decent, they absolutely are committed to what they believe, and they don't have the political and intellectual skill and force to be able to counter the SNP front benches, because the SNP have by and large kept their best people in Edinburgh, and the Scottish Labour have sent their best people down to London.
Does that mean, Sev, you've come? Does that mean you've come up with the answer to the question of what should Gordon Brown do now? Because if he's not going to be the head of the IMF, maybe he should become, you know, the life and soul of the Scottish Labour Party.
I think we can guarantee that would be disastrous for both concerned.
No, but I think that's a very interesting point that Martin raises there. That the SNP and Labour are vying for the same social democratic public sector high spending anti cuts vote. Their policies are almost identical now, even on things like higher education, which divided them previously. The obvious thing you would think at a time of national economic crisis, when they're faced by profound cuts in public spending and the dismantling of the state, might be for Labour and the SNP to form a kind of grand coalition and to promote these policies most effectively, send that message to Westminster. There's nothing inherently in either party which prevents them forming some kind of arrangement. Remember, the Nationalists and Labour are in power and have been in a coalition
in the Welsh Parliament.
Actually, Alexander has said the only thing he rules out in coalition formation is a coalition with the Tories. And while it does seem inconceivable that he would join with Labour under present circumstances, actually, I think there's a logic there.
This is all very hypothetical indeed, as Seb's saying, but you've said that the Tories remain an untouchable brand, even though they've actually connived in the passage of SNP budgets, of course. What I was interested in, Ian, is what about the Lib Dems? Because of what's going on at Westminster, are they as tainted too for Labour or the SNP to get into coalition with? And how badly do you think they're going to do?
Well, they're going to do very badly, I fear, and they're very sore about it. They're very hurt about it. In some ways, it's understandable. I mean, the Liberal Democrats are a federal party. The Scottish Party has its own agenda, has its own leader. The Scottish Party did not subscribe to the UK coalition's changes to tuition introduction, £9,000 cap on tuition fees south of the border. They opposed that in Scotland. The Liberal Democrats have opposed that consistently. And they have a very long tradition of support, particularly in the northern constituencies around Scotland. The further away you get from the beating heart of West Labour, heart of West Central Scotland, the more you see that the country is painted yellow. And they've been very successful in the past, but this is looking to be a disaster for them. And I think they will be lucky to come back with... I think they'll certainly lose a third of their seats, possibly more. They're bumping along in single figures in the opinion polls. They're desperately trying to distance themselves continually from the coalition in Westminster, even to the extent of putting words in Vince Cable's mouth, as they did, unfortunately, earlier this week when they rather hyped up what Vince was supposed to be going to be saying about how, you know, the Liberal Democrats, he's glad that the Tories are held in check by the Liberal Democrats. The coalition has gone down disastrously badly in Scotland for the Liberal Democrats, and I don't see any way out for them in this election.
We're going to have to leave Holyrood there for the moment. You can follow The Guardian's coverage of it at guardian.co.uk/Scotland. But we, of course, have 2 weeks to go also until the UK-wide referendum on the voting system. And the naysayers appear to have the momentum. Once you adjust for turnout, this week's Guardian ICM poll shows opponents of the AV system lead supporters by some 16 points, making it likely that First Past the Post is here to stay. Earlier in the week, we saw a couple of unlikely partnerships. First up, Ed Miliband tangoed with Vince Cable.
At every moment in a political contest, the choice comes down to hope versus fear.
If you reflect on what's happening in the Conservative Party, I mean, if they had had their choice of leader determined by First Past the Post rather than an alternative vote system, I would be now conducting my amicable, business-like coalition discussions on immigration with Mr David Davis.
Meanwhile, across London, David Cameron was joining forces with Labour's own Dr No, John Reid.
If the last election was under AV, there would be a chance right now that Gordon Brown would still be Prime Minister. Now, OK, I know the last election was not decisive in terms of who won, but I think it was decisive in terms of who lost.
The AV system, I mentioned, is passing, is complex, confusing, and costly, which is why it has been rejected by almost every other nation in the world when it comes to electing their own government. But above all, It is not fair, it is not equal, and it is not British.
Not British. Martin, the reformers might still be looking at the stars, but the politicians are now firmly in the gutter.
Well, I think the poll this week was pretty compelling. I mean, I take the discussion that we had earlier about whether polls can be reliable, and I think it's worth saying here that the question of AV is so unsalient, sorry to use an ugly word, in most people's minds. People don't know what it's about. They're not very engaged with it. But it's really, really hard to say what will motivate voters to go out and cast a vote in this election. And of course, you know, they don't really know very much about it. They don't really know very much about what the implications are. So, I mean, it's a very open election still. I think it's quite volatile, and a lot will depend, of course, on turnout. And turnout may be quite high in Scotland, for example, where people are going to go to polling stations in order to cast their votes for the Scottish Parliament.
An election everyone can see matters.
And then they will also get a voting paper on this. Likewise in Northern Ireland, likewise in Wales. In England, that's a bit less the case, because there are only local elections in most parts of England. And in London, there are no elections at all other than the AV referendum, or at least in most parts of London. So, you know, And London is quite a pro-AV area, according to the polls. So, you know, will people be motivated to go out? That's very, very unpredictable. I think the mood at the moment looks to be no. But you know, you only have to look at the most recent, very obscure referendum in Wales, which was on a very technical question about powers for the Welsh Assembly. Actually, people did turn out for that in quite surprising numbers, and they were very emphatic in favour of change. So, you know, the optimists have certainly shouldn't just sort of give up at this point, I think.
Severin, Scots are obviously used to voting with different systems. You've got this additional member system for Holyrood. Do you think that makes them more inclined to smile on AV for Westminster?
Well, in theory, yes. I mean, because Scotland effectively has three different ways of voting for people, because in the Scottish parliamentary system, you've got the list vote, which is a straight traditional first past the post. Then there's the second system, which is a form of STV for, sorry, the AMS for the list vote. And then you've got pure STV, the single transferable vote, that is, for local government elections in Scotland. That first came in for the first time in 2007. So, yeah, I mean, you instinctively, Scots will be more relaxed about this, more in tune with a proportional voting system. I have to say, though, and I think Ian will probably concur with this, that the AV campaign is just really failing to register in Scotland, because it isn't actually regarded as being particularly important and significant compared to the Holyrood poll. Now, you know, I've read a lot of commentary pieces about this. I read particularly Jackie Ashley's piece a couple of days ago on this particular issue about the Scottish elections potentially skewing, inverted commas, the overall AV outcome. Now, I think it's possible. It depends entirely on the proportion of Scottish voters versus English voters that turn out. You've got to remember, of course, that in 2007, only about 50% of eligible voters in Scotland voted for the Holyrood Parliament. So, you know, that's just under 2 million people. And I suspect it's entirely possible that many of those voters, wouldn't say a majority, but certainly many of them, may not even bother casting a vote on the AV referendum, because they simply haven't registered it, they're not terribly sure, and it's just getting no traction.
Ian, I gather you were elected as Rector of Edinburgh University using AV. Does that mean you're leaning towards yes? Or?
Yeah, well, it was in one constituency. The problem with the alternative vote, of course, is that it isn't actually proportional. I think this has been the fundamental problem with the AV campaign, rather like Labour's campaign north of the border. It is found in a degree of cynicism, in that the Liberal Democrats, who are campaigning hard for it, of course, rejected the alternative vote in the past, and Nick Clegg said it was a miserable little compromise. And that's because it does not necessarily deliver a proportional parliament, and that is a fundamental flaw. And I think perhaps for that reason, you might not get so many Scots actually voting for AV as everyone might expect, because you do experience up here of a genuinely proportional electoral system. the additional member system, which does ensure that the smaller parties do get some form of representation. In 2003, we had, I think it was 7 Scottish Socialist Party MSPs and 6 Greens, as well as an independent and a senior citizens a member. And you know, you can see how that works. The arguments for AV are extremely difficult. I find it extremely hard to sustain, except to the fact that because more seats will be determined on second preferences, it benefits the Liberal Democrats electorally. And I think that's, as I say, I think that's been a fundamental dishonesty, really, at the heart of the AV campaign. No, I'm not saying Ed Miliband is being dishonest. In fact, he stands, I think, to lose out via the alternative vote, particularly if the Tories use it as a means of cutting back on Labour constituencies and redrawing boundaries. But I think that is the essential problem with that campaign. And of course now it's degenerated to the stage where they're already behaving as bad losers.
Well, finally, if the debate on the alternative vote leaves you as cold as it sounds like it leaves Ian, then take a look at what's happening over in Hungary. The government in Budapest has proposed giving women with young children an additional vote, one for them and one for their young'un. A spokesman said the interests of future generations are not represented in decision making, and more votes for mums would address this. Martin, what do you think?
I think it's a complete non-starter, but I think if it was going to happen, you can see one good reason for it, and that is in almost every democracy I know anything about, it's old people who vote,
yeah,
and young people don't vote, and you know that is often said to be about to change, but it never really does change. Young people don't vote. So if you give a sort of proxy vote to mothers, I assume it's a proxy and that the little children won't actually have to go and make their squiggly X on the ballot paper, or their 1, 2, 3 if it goes to AV, then I think it's probably a way of redressing the balance. And in terms of public spending, of course, that would be quite an interesting thing to happen. Of course, it's not going to happen.
Severin, what do you think? Nice idea?
No, not particularly. I just find it extremely implausible. But it does produce the quite delightful idea that you could imagine mums having to think, well, what would I have thought when I was 10? You know, trying to reverse engineer their own politics back to the point at which when they were a child. I mean, one of the interesting things that comes up in Scotland, funnily enough, sort of drag it back here, is the SNP love the fact that young people are more likely to vote SNP than older people. The SNP have been trying to push this agenda to get the voting age in Scotland reduced to 16, precisely because
so
of that.
Why not 6?
Well, it's the optimism idea. It's the fact that younger voters are supposed to feel much more self-confident and forward-looking. They're much more aspirational. That's the kind of thought process the SNP try to plug into. Perhaps that's why.
And Ian, any thoughts?
Well, I mean, this is transparently an attempt by a very conservative party to shore up its pro-life vote, because they assume that mothers with young children are necessarily more conservative. I think that's probably a mistake. I don't think there's any particular evidence of that here, so they may be onto a loser. But I don't know, why stop there? Maybe we should. Maybe they should have fetuses should be given an imputed vote, or even farm animals.
And about the dead?
What about the dead? That's a very good point, because they have. They should have a say too.
Well, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks indeed to Ian McWhirter, Martin Gettle and Severin Carroll. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.